Dr. Hai Musse has been a champion for clinical research in elderly patients, and during the recent ASCO meeting, he presented in an oral session one of the only major randomized trials in oncology focusing on elderly patients. I met with Dr. Musse at ASCO just before he was about to receive the B.J. Kennedy Award for Scientific Excellence in Geriatric Oncology. We began our conversation by going back to the patient from Maui to get a third opinion on this tough case.
So 86, perfect health, you know, might have about a five-year average survival. And her risk of recurrence with this is probably substantial within that five-year range. It's probably 70-80% of the recurrences will be in that five-year range. And if you gave her, let's say, TC chemotherapy, you know, just as an example, avoiding anthracyclines, or she probably could handle AC even, you'd probably proportionally reduce her, you know, maybe by a third. So running it in my mind without the benefit of adjuvant online, even with seven positive nodes, she might pick up a few percent survival, you know, coming in on the comorbidity. And if she was interested in that, I might consider something like TC with using GCSF, using Neulasta. But I'll tell you, it's very iffy. It's very iffy, and it will interfere with her quality of life. It's definitely going to have some toxicity with regimen like that.
Any recollection what the oldest patient is that you've given adjuvant chemo to?
Probably low 80s. I don't know if I've done any 86. It's really pushing it out on the data. And she has to be in perfect health. That does not mean she looks good and is on, you know, antihypertensives. She's got to really have almost nothing there. And when people look into it, they don't have nothing there, you know. So she has to be in that upper quarter of healthy people, and it makes it very, very iffy. So I would have a discussion with her showing my ambivalence. And if she said, I really want to push for this on the numbers, I would consider doing it.
And you think most likely the regimen you'd use?
I'd probably use the TC because, you know, when you're older, you are at greater risk of heart disease. Most women like that, if she didn't get breast cancer, are going to die of heart disease or stroke. So I think maybe it takes a little edge off.
And if she breezed right through four cycles, would you go to six?
No.
So it's kind of interesting. All three of you said the same thing, and that's what the doc did.
Yeah.
And last I heard, she got the first dose and did pretty well.
Yeah.
But it's interesting how, you know, I know you were on the TC paper.
Right.
And, you know, I guess most recently, last December, they updated the data now with a survival advantage. And
right.
It's really been interesting to watch her. I guess now it's been about 2.5 years since that was first presented. As we've watched our patterns of care studies, how it's increased a lot.
Yeah.
And I assume you're using it more?
I'm using it more. I'm not a U.S. oncology
right.
member, but I ran into Steve Jones in a meeting about after he put it in JCO. I said, hey, Steve, you got a lot of old people on this. And he said, I don't know, Hai. And then he called me back a week later. I had 167 patients or something. I said, my God. You got a huge study here. No one has data. Let's look at it. So the next thing I knew, you know, he calls me up and says, I got data. And son of a gun, they had a survival advantage. And the paper just was sent to JCO in the last week or two. So I'm using a lot of TC.
But this is also in terms of the older patients. What was seen specifically in the older people?
So the older, when you take a study of 1,000 patients with a P equal 0.04 survival advantage and break it into two pieces,
right.
Neither has
it. Right.
Unless you had an interaction, a real
right.
age interaction, and you don't. So what you see is the same kind of thing like in our CLGB is the older people get similar proportional benefits to the younger people. They have poor overall survival because of competing causes of death, but their proportional benefit in relapse is similar to younger patients. They had a little bit more toxicity, you know, 8 versus 4% neutropenic fever. So, you know, judging from issues, I would tend to use growth factors from the get-go in those patients.
What age would make you start using growth factors for TC?
Well, we cut off at 65, so I think that's reasonable. Or younger age, if there was, you know, substantial comorbidity or other, you know, you were worried like they had COPD and, you know, you get a pneumonia and get septic, I would use kind of get some of Gary Lyman's risk factors and things.
What do you see in terms of just sort of people getting through it and sort of their general state of health with TC as they get in their 70s?
I think from the data we looked at with Steve and the study, it's pretty well tolerated. I think there is a lot of fatigue with it. I mean, I think we see fatigue with all chemotherapy, but I think that docetaxel, you know, whatever the mechanism, someday we'll learn whether it's making more IL-6 or TNF or whatever is happening, stimulating more of that is a little bit tougher on patients. But the nice thing is you're not worried about a cardiac toxicity profile. The neutropenia is concerning, using 75 per meter square of docetaxel. Most patients get neutropenic, but neutropenic fever has been uncommon.
What about leukemia? What do we know about the relationship between chemo-induced leukemia and age?
So if you look at the SEER data and you look at women above 65, they have a 1% risk of AML. If you look at chemotherapy, like in a big SEER base, it was a hazard ratio of 1.6 to 2. And when they look at anthracyclines, the hazard ratio, you know, was like 2.1, 2.2. So I think that there is a concern with age, and anthracyclines, which are associated with those chromosomal abnormalities for topo II inhibiting agents in leukemia, those leukemias tend to occur, you know, 4 to 8 years out, maybe aren't, you know, ironically, for someone who's very old. But in our CLGB data, we look at elderly toxicity, dying of treatment-related events, at least within the issues of discussions you can get about appropriate coding. What we found was the major problem was MDS-AML. It wasn't heart, probably because we put very healthy patients in the trial. But the MDS-AML is a concern. And in CLGB 9741, the DOSTENCE trial led by the CLGB, Mark Citrin, based on Larry Norton's ideas, updated with Cliff Huddis, the last view we did, the incidence of AML-MDS was 0.7%. That's pretty high. And when you go in your adjuvant online and you get a 1% survival benefit and you look at all of that and put it in, you've got to give it a lot of thought.
What do you think about this thought about, well, maybe we can't really impact mortality, but we can prevent the patient from going through the experience of recurrence in the next, you know, 2 to 3 years?
I think it's pretty good. I mean, we're all mortal. I think we forget that. And when the patient comes in that day, I often feel that when you're sitting there, the patient is perceiving that they're immortal, but the breast cancer is now going to cut into it. The reality is we're all very mortal, and we don't look at quality of life. We're so into longevity and, you know, living a few years longer. Of course, when we get in a big discussion, we talk about quality of life, not quantity of life, et cetera. So I think probably the same arguments with using progression-free survival in clinical trials. I think it is very important to prevent the recurrence of a potentially fatal disease, you know, in all of us who have a finite survival, because I think when you get those Mets or another primary to deal with when you're older and go through the whole, certainly more surgery and radiation and discussions of adjuvant therapy, that if I can prevent that in a substantial enough group of patients, I think as far as caring for other human beings, it's a good thing.
You know, you're, I guess, in about an hour about to give a talk for an award you're receiving, the B.J. Kennedy Cancer in the Elderly Award, is that?
That's correct, yes.
So I'm sure you've given a lot. Obviously, you've been a leader in the field, but in terms of, you've probably given a lot of thought to what you're about to say this afternoon. Can you kind of summarize the message?
The name of the talk is Breast Cancer in Older Women, the Silent Majority.
So yeah, I like that.
I think one of the messages is the majority of breast cancers in the United States are in older women. The average age is 64 years now. Most of the deaths, 65 years and older. Yet I think the vignette in people's mind is younger patients, advertisements. And certainly when you see a younger patient with 3 children and a terrible breast cancer, it's probably a different emotional experience than seeing someone who's 80 years old with the same pathology. That being said, we're a fairly healthy population, and many of the older people have been undertreated with potentially beneficial therapy, hence the first question we discussed today. So my message is going to be the extent of the problem, the fact that we're going to see more older people with breast cancer because our population is aging. By 2025, 20% of Americans will be 65 and older. It's 12% now. That older people, although they have a little bit more favorable tumor biology as a group with more ERPR positive tumors, less likely to have positive lymph nodes, these numbers are relatively small. And stage for stage, they do as poorly as younger patients. So the message there is to consider them like younger patients, factoring in comorbidity, which is key, as best we can do them, and offer them the best therapy. And then the last message is, one is clinical trials, still woefully low in accruals of older patients. And then lastly, who's going to take care of them? We're losing primary care physicians in the U.S., internists. There aren't as many geriatricians as medical oncologists. And most of the survivors of breast cancer now, a large percent that Patty Gans and other people are talking about, are older women. They're not women in their 30s. They're actually women in their 60s and 70s. And whatever issues, long-term issues we learn about with their therapy is going to have to be addressed by healthcare providers who know a little bit about the disease and the toxicities. In many of our older people, cancer is the comorbid disease. It's their diabetes and heart disease where the money is, and not their 5-millimeter, well-differentiated, infiltrating ductal cancer. But it's been a very hard sell, you know, as an area of interest, even though when you talk to medical oncologists, they're well aware of the problem and the people they're seeing who are older. Colon cancer, for instance. You talk to the guys doing colon cancer.
Absolutely.
They're older people.
Right.
On average, older prostate. Than breast cancer. Prostate. Even lung.
Lung, for sure.
You know, more lymphomas. So
right.
I think we're getting the message out. And I think what's really the hard thing for medical oncologists to learn is how to factor in the other comorbidity and other issues related to older people, like activities of daily living. Can they use the telephone? Are they driving? Things we're not used to thinking about. It's a big challenge.
You mentioned the issue of research, and this is really a landmark ASCO meeting, and that you're reporting, I think, one of the first, if not the first, randomized phase 3 studies specifically focusing on elderly women, the CALGB study. Can you talk about what you're reporting here?
Yeah, it is one of the first. There was a French study previously published looking at weekly epirubicin and tamoxifen versus tamoxifen alone several years ago, but this is one of the first in the United States. And what we did is we compared standard chemotherapy, in which a physician, if a patient was randomized to standard chemotherapy, could pick CMF with oral cyclophosphamide or AC, as defined by NSABP with every three-week doses, or capecitabine, given orally for 2 consecutive weeks every 3.
And what was the eligibility?
The eligibility, you had to be 65 years and older. You had to have a tumor greater than or equal to a centimeter. And any nodal status, any HER2 status, an estimated survival of 5 years and normal organ function.
So what did you see?
So what we found was we had done a trial on the hypothesis that, based on some trials in metastatic breast cancer, that single-agent capecitabine would be non-inferior. And this was how the trial was designed. This was a very clever design by Don Berry. An adaptive design based on Bayesian statistics, rather unique. It's one of the first trials where we picked a specific time between 600 patients with a maximum of 1,800 patients to look at the trial and calculate what the likelihood would be that the capecitabine was non-inferior to the AC. And we also had cutoffs to stop the trial if the capecitabine was actually inferior. Or very likely to be inferior. This is different than standard designs that pick cutoffs and, you know, O'Brien-Fleming boundaries to stop trials. And after accruing 600 patients, we did our first analysis and showed that it was very likely that capecitabine was inferior to CMF or AC, and we stopped accrual. And that was in November of 2006. We ended up with 633 accruals. And we've updated the events now, and there's a highly significant benefit for both relapse-free and overall survival for patients treated with standard chemotherapy, either classical CMF or AC, compared to patients treated with capecitabine.
And what's your take on what's going on here?
Well, we did an unplanned subset analysis, and what's nice about this trial was 2/3 of the patients are over 70, so it's not like they're all 66 and 2/3 are over 70. Most of the patients are node positive. About 1/3 of the patients are triple negative, or at least double negative. We're still looking at the HER2 data. And what we found was an interaction between treatment and outcome, specifically that patients who were estrogen and progesterone receptor negative, or we lumped them together, hormone receptor negative patients, most had the greatest bang for the buck with the CMFAC compared to the capecitabine. For the hormone receptor positive patients, there wasn't as obvious a difference. It may turn out to be in time. So the major difference driver was in the hormone receptor negative patients.
I guess we've seen a whole issue about the issue of chemo and ER positive patients to start with.
So. Sure. And older people and different tempo of the disease, it's hard to know, you know, and then the adage of how many of these people, based on things like Oncotype testing today or any of the gene arrays, what would be the overall benefit of chemotherapy one might expect in this group? And perhaps we'll look at that in time because we have tremendous resources, including over 500 tissue blocks.
What did you see? I mean, obviously the objective here was to hopefully find something that would be easier on the patient.
Yeah.
What did you observe both clinically and what did you see in terms of data, in terms of how people tolerated the two approaches?
Well, we had all hoped and would have liked to have seen an oral agent be as good as standard therapy. And I should parenthetically add that although our trial shows these data, and I believe we have excellent data, there is an ongoing trial now in Europe led by Dr. von Minkowitz and German group looking at, it's called the ICE trial, I-C-E, and everybody gets abandronate. And it includes patients who are ER positive and ER negative, and they are randomized to capecitabine alone or no treatment. It's not placebo controlled. And I ran into Dr. von Minkowitz, and he told me that he has about 1,350 of his 1,400 planned patients accrued. So this is going to tell us a lot about just the use of the oral agent and will be very important data in context of our trial.
It's interesting. Of course, you didn't have a no treatment control.
We don't have a no. That's right.
What do you think they're going to see there?
They may be a little lower risk than our patients, but I think earlier on, a lot of those patients are going to do well and probably see very little benefit from the chemotherapy. The patients who are hormone receptor positive get endocrine therapy. In the ER negative patients, I'd like to believe that capecitabine is going to have some value. It just may not be as great a value as more aggressive chemotherapy. Evidence for that, Don Berry's analysis of CALGB trials, where when he looked at ERPR negative patients in his JMA paper, he showed that as we got more aggressive chemotherapy and used taxanes and went to dose dense, we got more and more improved proportional reductions in relapse in ERPR negative patients. So I'd like to believe that capecitabine would be helpful, but it wouldn't be as good as a more modern, more aggressive regimen.
Let's talk a little bit about management of the older patient in a variety of situations and start right out with metastatic disease, kind of as a follow-up to the adjuvant situation in terms of the issue of chemotherapy and bevacizumab and where capecitabine fits in nowadays in metastatic disease and specifically in the older patient. How do you think through your algorithm in this situation, and does it change at all when the patient gets to be 70 or 80?
I don't think so. I tend to use a lot of capecitabine first line. I believe that it's well tolerated. I start with lower dosage. I believe still that I don't believe there's enough data out there telling me the ideal dose to use. The package insert dose was too high. I suspect most physicians are using 2,000 or lower doses, but I talk to physicians that are starting like at 1 gram BID. And so it depends. I have a lot of patients that will say, Dr. Muss, I really don't want to take any chemotherapy, and I certainly don't want to get sick or anything. And I try to reassure them that I've got a pill, that it's real chemotherapy, and I started a low dose. I feel I can always escalate it. But if the patient developed a terrible toxicity from the get-go and I wouldn't have the opportunity to treat her, I've really lost a good option. So I still think capecitabine is an excellent choice to initiate chemotherapy in metastatic breast cancer, irrespective of age. But I think it's very reasonable to do, and certainly in older people.
And what we're seeing, you know, I think in practice in the first-line setting is the issue of capecitabine versus a taxane with Bev. But there's also the, and I want to ask you about that, but there's also the issue of capecitabine plus Bev. And I'm curious what your thoughts are about that clinically, as well as the data that we've seen there.
Yeah. I think as far as capecitabine versus a Taxol with Bev, I think that at least in the pivotal trial by Kathy Miller, looking at paclitaxel with or without bevacizumab, the E2100 trial, there certainly was a very, at least to me, meaningful improvement in progression-free survival. But without an overall survival benefit in a very clean trial, it tells me that I can use the kinder, gentler therapy up front without really compromising the longevity of my patient. At least I think that's what the data tell me. So I think that if I had a patient who had more extensive metastases where a doubling time or two, the patient is going to be very sick. I don't mean a few little scattered liver mets. I mean enough to where the next one will start moving the alkaline phosphatase up substantially, or bone mets, which are really painful. Patient comes in and there's a lot of lytic lesions and a lot of pain, or extensive pulmonary metastases, you know, another doubling, the patient's going to be short of breath. I would lean towards the paclitaxel bevacizumab. But I suspect most of the patients we see today, especially in some physicians who still prefer to do lots of scans and follow-up studies, that a lot of the patients are picked up when they're minimally symptomatic, and that you don't have to be highly aggressive worrying about one tumor doubling and not getting an opportunity to treat them.
So let's just make this a clean question and just say the patient's never had a taxane, they have metastatic disease, you give them capecitabine, at some point they progress. Are you going to then be using taxane and Bev?
Yes.
And you use.
And I realize the data aren't there to support me in second line, but I have done that.
You used the term before ataxol and Bev, and I guess that brings in the issue of NAB. What are your thoughts about that? What are your thoughts about that with Bev, with trastuzumab, and in the elderly?
I think that nab-paclitaxel is a very exciting drug. It has a different potential mechanism of action. But it's never been compared to weekly paclitaxel. It's been compared to 100 of docetaxel and Bill Gratishar's randomized phase 2 trials. So I tend to use the paclitaxel. If there are any allergic reactions or other things, I move to the nab-paclitaxel. And I would love to see a randomized trial. The CLGB is going to be looking at nab-paclitaxel versus paclitaxel in one of its studies, I believe.
That's the metastatic setting.
Yeah, in metastatic right. setting. And I think that'll be very interesting.
And that's with Bev.
With Bev.
And then there's another arm there with Ix.
That's right,
so
with Ix.
Everybody gets Bev and then there's three options.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's pretty cool.
And I think we'll learn a lot from that trial.
What about this study looking at Bev with either Ix, NAB, or paclitaxel? What do you think we're going to see?
Well, it's a hard call. You know, from a science and patient point of view, I'd like to see one arm win. And the nab-paclitaxel has a unique mechanism of action, perhaps with the spark interactions and active transport in the cancer cells. If I was a betting man in my heart of hearts, I'm not sure we'll see a vast difference in metastatic disease. But I'd like to see one of the experimental arms win because I think it would be better for the patients in the long run and perhaps give us some ideas for the future of better adjuvant therapy.
I think the last time I talked to you was about 4 or 5 months ago, and I think you told me you haven't been using much Ix yet. Have you used it at all?
No, not yet.
What do you think the potential role is, at least right now?
Well, I think it's an exciting drug. I think using it in combination, it was fairly toxic in the NDA study, you know, a lot of neuropathy.
With the capecitabine.
With the capecitabine. And I'm a single agent person for the most part. I think it's a good drug to have out there. I think there's an option, you know, third line therapy, fourth, maybe even earlier. But I don't have vast experience. Some of the single agent data to me in heavily treated patients is pretty interesting. And perhaps it'll be a winner in the CLGB trial.
It's interesting. You know, that patterns of care study that you helped us do, the most recent one in breast cancer, one of the questions we asked, actually Hal Burstein had emailed me and asked to put in there was, you know, in your last 5 patients who died of breast cancer, how many lines of chemotherapy did they get? And it was around 5 or 6,
yeah.
Which I guess doesn't surprise you.
No.
And in spite of that, you still haven't used Ix yet. I find that interesting.
Well, one of the reasons is I think I'm seeing what a lot of medical oncologists are seeing who care for breast cancer. I'm not seeing as many patients with metastatic disease as I used to. And when I talk to friends in pharma and things with clinical trials, we're doing better. And these stats are probably affecting the number of women with metastatic disease I see. And just think of it. Most of them are going to be ER positive. And so I'm going to try hormones till they run out. and then go on to the other drugs. So I will get to use ixabepilone, but I'll bet I have less than a patient a month develop Mets, and I'm carrying probably 1,000 to 1,500 patient practice.
You know, it's interesting. Chuck Vogel is also on the same audio program as the one you're going to be on, and he made the exact same comment. He said that his practice is shifting towards a lot less metastatic disease.
Yeah.
That sounds like a good thing.
And it follows, there's been a 30% reduction since 1992 in the major stats in dying of breast cancer. And I think what's happening is we're just doing much better. And it's a common comment in many of the presentations now that when they power their study on events, the events they planned for were much higher than what they're seeing. So even in this Ganon study, very popular now, you look at really how the patients are doing, and they're all doing great.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, Mike is on the same program as you also. I just interviewed him an hour ago, and one of the things that was really striking about that study where they didn't use any chemotherapy, and these were premenopausal women with ER positive, and they had node positive patients in there too. I think they had about a 6% relapse rate at 5 years.
It's incredible. So it's good.
So what were your thoughts about, I guess, the study of ASCO, which is this Austrian study showing what seems to be a pretty significant 35% reduction in relapse rate using zoledronate?
Well, I think it's intriguing. I think we're all waiting for the NSABP trial on cladrenate, where we got our first clues, although there are of the several studies done, the Trevor Pohl study, the Scandinavian, we're a little different. But at least we're provoked into the fact that bisphosphonate therapy, and there's some preclinical biology that supports, could have an effect on metastases. I hope to see the NSABP trial with the cladrenate.
They're saying the same thing about the fact there are not that many events.
Yeah. So I found this trial intriguing. For one, I think the fact that the anastrozole was not better than the tamoxifen was somewhat a little surprising to me, because essentially all these people were made postmenopausal with, I believe, gosarilin, and then they were randomized to anastrozole or tamoxifen. So there isn't a difference. It'll be interesting to see our TEXT trial, which is exemestane versus tamoxifen with ovarian suppression that's been close to accrual. So I thought that was interesting, and I think we were all surprised to see the experimental, what I would consider the major experimental arm added in here, the zoledronic acid every 6 months, to be superior. But even with that lowered hazard ratio, the absolute benefit is a few percent at 5 years. They, to my knowledge, saw no osteonecrosis in this trial, which I personally think is an overplayed complication in spite of some studies that show astronomical rates, which is not what most of us see. It was pretty well tolerated, and I think it's going to probably be widely used. Although, as Eric Weiner commented on the study and others have, it'd be nice to see a little bit more corroborative data. We always say that, but I don't know what the study would be. I suspect this is going to be used by oncologists because zoledronic acid is a lot different in concept for getting a few percent improvement in relapse rate as opposed to chemotherapy, where the toxicities are much more profound.
So when you say oncologist, how about you?
Yeah, I will probably consider it in younger patients. I certainly discuss it with them.
What about older patients?
Well, it's intriguing. I can't think of a reason biologically why they should be much difference. After all, this study, we made everybody an older patient. We made them postmenopausal by suppressing their ovarian function. So essentially, we did that. And then we compared tamoxifen and a aromatase inhibitor. And then we randomized to the zoledronic acid or not. So essentially, they were a chemically induced postmenopausal group. And I can't think of a good biologic rationale while the data might not hold for older people. And in fact, as you got people old enough, you're going to have osteopenia and osteoporosis and may want to do it anyway.
And actually, it's interesting because the first time I interviewed Mike was 2004 when he presented the data on bone,
right,
which I was really struck with at the time, showing it seemed like it totally abrogated the negative bone effect of AIs.
Right. And Charlie Shapiro had an abstract looking at zoledronic acid, people with chemo-induced amenorrhea on the program, and it works. So I think that if you're going to be doing ovarian suppression in younger people, even without this benefit, a lot of people may be to prevent bone loss, which could be, you know, we haven't followed people into their 60s and 70s after being treated in their 30s and looked at, I think there's about 40,000 deaths a year from fractures in the U.S. So we don't know if in 20 years we're going to have a lot of young women who we've cured with breast cancer, but ablated or modified their ovarian function enough that their fracture risk could be a major problem in years to come. So I think it's going to be a popular consideration.
I guess the other thing is, in terms of the postmenopausal woman, again, if they're going to get an AI, which we know from patterns of care is most likely what's going to happen, you know, the whole concern about bone, so you're kind of sort of synergized. I remember when Mike Baum presented the ATTACC data in 2001, right after that, right before it, Trevor Pals had presented one of those original, you know, I think it was Cladrenate to prevent Mets. Right. It was positive. I mean, he right there in the ATTACC presentation said, you know, maybe this is all going to come together, and it looks like now it's starting to happen. What about the patient with the ER-negative tumor and Zoledronate?
You mean using it?
For that purpose.
Well, I'd have to give it thought, you know. I think...
I see the wheels turning.
Yeah.
I was asking about Mike about the same thing. He was, you know, I mean, it's like how much evidence base do you need and all this. So it is kind of tricky to think that thing through, although, and I think there are other studies that are looking at ER negative, but just inherently whether you would expect that to change this. I mean, I guess it could.
It's possible. I mean, I think we need to know more about the biology here. Could there be an interaction of zoledronic acid, perhaps with cancer cells that are ER positive? Is it a seed and soil thing where we do something in the marrow that's more favorable for ER positive cells than ER negative cells? And I don't think we have that level of biology yet, of science.
So the last thing I want to talk to you about, and again, try to bring in the perspective of the older patient, is HER2 positive disease. And we actually saw some interesting stuff here at this meeting related to that. In the adjuvant setting, one of the questions that's been debated ever since the adjuvant trastuzumab trials came out is the older patient, particularly one with comorbidities, particularly one who normally you wouldn't be thinking about giving chemotherapy to, and the question of using trastuzumab without chemo, maybe with hormones or not. What do you think about that strategy, and what about clinical research looking at these people?
Well, I think it would be great to have a clinical trial of trastuzumab or not, especially in older patients. Although, as we talked about before, if they're healthy, there's no reason not to integrate the chemotherapy into it. And if they're unhealthy, we probably need to fine-tune that comorbidity in them to really, you know, see if they have a lot of comorbidity enough that you wouldn't consider the chemotherapy, and you use some of the data, at least from the metastatic trials, and try to get some kind of risk reduction estimates, whether it would be worth doing, especially on women with smaller tumors, node-negative tumors that are HER2 positive. I think it would be nice to get a study. I kind of think it'd be hard to do it, you know, conceptually, because I think if patients are healthy, they're going to get the chemotherapy and trastuzumab. And I think you'd be left with a lot of people who were sicker or more frail, and then you're going to have to randomize them. They're going to have smaller tumors, lower event rates. And once we sat down and really looked at what kind of sample size we need, I think it would be very hard to do. Might lend to Don Barry's Bayesian, you know, analysis. It was a slam dunk up front, beneficial to do it.
I guess there aren't that many people out there like that. Have you done that, used trastuzumab without chemo?
I have not.
What are some of the lesser toxic chemotherapy regimens you'll switch to? I remember you presented a case using the Steve Jones TC plus trastuzumab. What are you doing in these older people in terms of chemo?
Well, there is a trial now that's open that we're going to join into looking at weekly paclitaxel and trastuzumab. I believe that Dana-Farber is running the trial, and we're going to join in. And I think it makes good sense because from a practical point of view, we think it's going to be hard to randomize the patients. We know that paclitaxel and trastuzumab is a very effective combination from the metastatic setting by itself. Weekly paclitaxel, to me, has been a reasonably well-tolerated chemotherapy irrespective of age. So I think that it's a good design. It's a modest amount of chemotherapy. It's 12 cycles of weekly paclitaxel. I think that that's a good design. And I think it's interesting. Should you do that outside of a clinical trial? Well, I would pick something like TC if the patient was healthy enough.
TC plus trastuzumab.
Plus the trastuzumab. a la how Herod did things. Or I guess you could integrate it in. I've done that, but I don't know if it's the right thing.
What about metastatic disease and the issue now that we have another alternative in terms of anti-HER2 therapy and lapatinib, about how you choose between lapatinib and trastuzumab and sequence them?
Well, I think from a personal level, if the patient has metastatic breast cancer and never had trastuzumab and does not have CNS mets, I have used a trastuzumab-containing combination. I've used vinorelbine, which I think is a pretty user-friendly drug. It's a little myelosuppressing, but it's otherwise pretty well tolerated, or you can use paclitaxel. I don't know if there's really a vast difference there. I think if someone presented de novo now with brain mets, quite honestly, who had been on neither of the agents, I'd probably pick the lapatinib and might even consider something like capecitabine with it, which penetrates the CSF. These patients will usually be radiated too, but it's a major issue. So that might be reasonable. Perhaps if they've immediately come off adjuvant therapy, and I've had very few patients like that, quite honestly, as we're talking about relapse. I think my trastuzumab-treated patients as a group are doing very, very well. So I don't see many of them. We talk about it, but I don't see them.
I've been hearing that from people. I don't know if that's just sort of a mental trick we're playing, or we see, clinically, we know relapses are going to occur.
Maybe we're just delaying them. And it's going to be like some of the things we've realized now from the overview, that most of our relapses in the ER-positive patients are after 5 years. And those hazard ratios are out to year 15, and maybe they're going to go out to year 20. So I think that what my strategy has been, if I saw one of those relapses very quickly after giving them a year of trastuzumab, I probably use the lapatinib in those patients.
What's your experience been clinically with lapatinib and lapatinib CAPE?
Yeah, so I don't have a vast experience, maybe 5-10 patients. I have found the lapatinib CAPE pretty well tolerated. I have a patient who's had folliculitis, which has been a problem, although she's a physician and she's led me on the literature and managed it pretty well with antibiotic-containing creams.
Folliculitis where?
We had scalp, we had nose, arms, almost like a bad acne-like reaction, which has been described.
This is lapatinib?
Lapatinib. Which we've got under very good control.
And what are you using for it?
It's a topical antibiotic ointment. There's some literature on this, especially with other EGFR inhibitors, where it's more common to get rashes and things. And got it managed well. That's the only one. The other patients I've had have tolerated the 1250 milligram daily dose very well with capecitabine. I probably have 3 or 4 patients now currently on that, and I usually know it by how many calls I have to return at the end of the day, and tolerating it well.
Where do you think things are heading in terms of long-term management of metastatic HER2-positive disease in terms of, in the past we just sort of kept trastuzumab going indefinitely, sequencing, combinations, where do you think we're heading?
Well, I think some of the combination data that I'm aware of is intriguing, nice to look at it. In some newer trials together, like we're doing maybe in the ALTO trial in the adjuvant setting.
Right.
Metastatic disease to me is always tougher because by the time you get those patients that are hormone refractory, their lives, a lot of those patients are short, unless they're that small but very impressive group of patients who get trastuzumab who do well for years. And we always talk about them, but they are a minority of the patients. So I think that there are a lot of new compounds that are out there, and we need some good trials to explore them.